freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, buying coke, buying Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say, we don't have anything to do.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them, they're just selling proof. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. A mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news good.
What we need to know.
News good.
What we want to know.
News good.
What we think we know.
Got remote control to choose a show. But the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of The Other Side. Today on our show, we're lucky to have Mr. Michael Shapcott, co-chair of the TDRC Committee in Toronto, researcher, writer, and policy analyst for the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. For our listeners that aren't familiar with your work, perhaps you can give us an overview.
For about the last 20 years, I've been a housing and homelessness advocate. Currently, I work at the Centre for Urban and Community Studies at the University of Toronto, which is an urban affairs research institute. I coordinate the Community University Research Partnerships Unit, which is a real mouthful, but basically what it means is that I work in the university, but I work with community-based groups, mainly housing groups, but also environmental groups and others, in terms of helping them to identify issues, to identify solutions, and to move ahead on things. So some of the groups that I work with are the National Housing and Homelessness Network, which, of course, the name suggests, spans the entire country from Vancouver to St. John's is composed of community-based housing advocates right across the country. I work with the Housing and Homelessness Network in Ontario, which is the provincial counterpart in about two dozen communities across the province of Ontario, and locally in Toronto with groups like the Toronto Disaster Relief Committee, which has been one of the leading housing and homeless groups in the city since 1998. So those are a few of the connections that I have in terms of my work on housing and homelessness.
You have some published reports.
That's right. It's my work at the university. I do publish research on a variety of issues involving poverty, housing, homelessness. Some of it is original research that I've obviously gone out and done myself. Also provide analysis on developing issues. So whenever there's a federal budget, a provincial budget, whenever there's a major policy announcement by governments, I will put out that information. Now, a number of the research reports that I put out are published by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, which is a major think tank that's based in Ottawa. And in particular, over the years, they published a number of my studies on housing issues and housing policies in Ontario.
I think I was quoting in one of the past shows some of your findings that was published in the Policy for Alternatives, more poignantly to do with lobby groups and trying to show some of the problems with the housing that did not get built, even though there was a lot of promises by the Tory government over the last 8 years.
That's right. Earlier this year, I published a paper with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives that looks over the last 8 years or so under the Harris and now Eves provincial governments in Ontario, and looks at their housing policies, what they promised and what they actually delivered. And it takes a behind-the-scenes look because, as many of your listeners will know, in 1995, when the Harris government was first elected, it got elected on a very radical set of policy options for housing. Basically wanted to toss out all of the very successful social housing policies that had helped to build hundreds of thousands of units across the country, including here in Ontario, over the previous 25 or so years. Wanted to toss all that stuff out, and it said housing, social housing is a boondoggle. It's they called, in fact, a billion-dollar boondoggle. They ran a big smear campaign and said, we're going to let the private sector handle everything, and we're just going to turn it all over to them, and we're not going to have any more of this too expensive social housing. In fact, what was happening in the years leading up to the election of the Harris government was there was a very concerted lobby by private development interests, including representatives of landlord lobby groups, in order to get the Harris government to buy into their agenda and to basically ditch this very successful agenda that had been in place before to build affordable social housing.
The lobby groups approached the government before all of these policies and programs were changed?
Well, there's no question that there was a relationship with the Tories before they got elected in 1995, but what's really fascinating is how quickly they got in the door once Mike Harris was settled in as premier. Harris was elected, of course, in June of 1995, and the very first cabinet meeting of that new government, which was held towards the end of June in 1995, Harris emerged from the cabinet meeting, and almost the very first thing he announced was that they were moving ahead on their very radical housing agenda, including they were going to cancel. At that point, they said they were going to cancel about 20,000 units of co-op and nonprofit housing that had already been approved for development, but the government decided it was too expensive to proceed. In the end, there was a bit of a political battle, and about 3,000 units were saved, but 17,000 units were lost. Mm-hmm. Behind the scenes, what was happening was that these developer lobby groups set up a meeting with the Minister of Housing at the time. His name was Al Leach. And in fact, that there was a very secret meeting that took place in September of 1995, so just a few months after they were elected, where the developers set a shopping list in front of the housing minister. They said, get rid of social housing. They said, get rid of rent controls. They said, get rid of demolition and conversion controls, the laws which prevent buildings from that are currently rental buildings from being demolished or converted into non-rental uses.
Condos, right?
Yeah, the condos and commercial properties and so on. So they had a whole shopping list of things that they wanted the government to do. So they sat down in September of 95 in a meeting with the minister, and through a friendly source that I had in the provincial government at the time, we were able to get a copy of the document that the private sector lobby groups presented to the minister saying, here's what we want you to do. And when you sit down and look at that and compare that to what the government actually did, then you see it's check, check, check. Mm-hmm. They did everything that they were asked to do, and they did it very enthusiastically. And so by 1998, we had the rent control laws gutted, the landlord-tenant laws substantially changed, we had the demolition and conversion laws had been repealed. Social housing, of course, was no longer being funded. In fact, was being downloaded to municipalities.
Mm-hmm.
Just go through the whole list and see how stunningly successful they were. And
wasn't there incentive, though, that they couldn't afford to build new affordable housing units that the government was counting on unless these demands were met?
Well, that was their argument. And certainly it's absolutely true that they can't afford to build, they couldn't then and they can't now afford to build housing for very low-income people. And the reason is not ideology, but it's simple economics.
Mm-hmm.
That when you're talking about a household, let's say, with an annual income of $10,000 or less, you know, they only have a certain amount of money they can afford to pay for rent. If you're a developer and you want to develop a property, you've got the cost of acquiring land, you've got the cost of building the building, you've got the financing costs, you've got the operational costs, plus you want to make a return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
To give back to the investors that put money into your property, and that return on investment has to be at least equal to what that investor would get if they stuck it in the shopping mall or a condo or some other project like that. So all those costs begin to add up, and the math just doesn't work out. So what the Harris government said was, they said, okay, we'll take away rent controls. What they did was they established what's called vacancy decontrol, which means that whenever a unit is vacant, there's no more rent control, so a landlord can charge whatever they want, which incidentally is a heck of an incentive for a landlord to want to try and drive as many tenants out of their property as possible, because every tenant you get out, ka-ching, the rent goes up.
It's just a cash cow for a private developer, then.
It is, and the theory is, as rents go up, then that means landlords are going to be making more money, and that means that it might make it economically more possible to build private rental units. And in fact, but as rents go up, low-income, moderate-income households can no longer afford those rents anymore, so you end up with the situation where rents have now increased thanks to the government's interventions, and again, thanks to these huge rent increases, it is now possible for a developer to develop a rental unit, put it onto the market, and get the return that they want. Mm-hmm. But the kind of rents that they have to pitch that at are $1,300, $1,500 a month and up. And that simply is well out of range of renter households, especially the folks that are very, very poor. Just to give you an idea of the kind of numbers we're talking about in Ontario, there are slightly less than 300,000 households. Now, this, again, I emphasize households, not people, but households. So you have to multiply it by about 2.5. So probably we're talking about 750,000 people who live in households where their annual income is less than $11,000 a year.
Wow.
So what can they afford for rent? They can afford about a rent of about $3,000 a year, which is...
So they have absolutely no alternative now. If there's no subsidized housing by the government, and the government is actually expecting private developers to make low-income housing or expecting a trickle-down theory, which we know is not going to happen.
Right.
But that's how they're selling it. So there's no place for these people to go.
Well, absolutely. And again, it's the fundamental law of economics, which in theory you'd think that a right-wing government that's pro-business would understand, and you'd think that the private development sector would just simply say, look, there's no way that we can possibly ever build any housing that's affordable for those 300,000. Just let the social housing sector continue to do it. God bless them.
There is no social housing sector left anymore.
Well, in terms of new development, it's very sketchy. Now, there has been some movement in the last couple of years, especially on the federal level. There's been a couple of programs starting in 1999 with a program called SCPI, the Supporting Community Partnerships Initiative, which was mainly geared at helping homeless people in terms of temporary shelter, but some groups have successfully turned some of that SCPI money into new affordable housing in a half a dozen places across the country. We've also seen in November 2001, the federal government put $680 million across the country over 5 years into new affordable housing. Now, none of that money has yet made its way into Ontario because, unfortunately, in order for it to come to Ontario, it requires a cost-sharing agreement with the provincial government.
And Ontario hasn't come forward. They've downloaded it.
Has absolutely refused to. They keep offering and saying, well, as our provincial share, we'll take money from Hamilton and other municipalities. We'll make that our share. So they're trying to do all sorts of devious backroom.
What they've done is turned around to the municipalities and say, pull it out of your property tax bills and come up with, I think it was, 80% of the margin that
That's
was
right.
expected from the province, which I think is just ridiculous to expect. And in some areas, the quotes from Sheila Copps that have said, why don't we just do away with the middleman, the provincial government, and have the federal government and the municipal government work directly together?
Well, and Sheila Copps, God bless her, is saying exactly what housing advocates have been saying since November 2001. We said that the theory of cost sharing with the province and territories is a good theory, because in theory, it means that you're doubling your money because you got the federal $680 million, you got $680 from the provinces and territories, so that means you've got a nice little pot of money. And it worked for a while in Quebec because it's, there was cost-sharing to a lesser extent in British Columbia and a few other jurisdictions where the provinces were somewhat serious about it. But here in Ontario, in a number of the Atlantic provinces, it just hasn't worked for a number of years now. The National Housing and Homelessness Network and other advocacy groups at the national level have been saying, cut out the provinces. If they're not willing to play, then the feds should deal directly with municipalities or even with housing providers. Despite all these bad years since 1995 when the Harris government canceled things, there still are groups in Hamilton and right across the country who are ready and able to start building new social housing right away if they get the proper support. And as I say, there's a little patchwork that's beginning to emerge.
Meaning support from where? Not from the province, obviously.
Well, they're not getting support from the province, and quite frankly, they can't expect anything from the current government in Ontario. The Conservatives have made it painfully clear that not only are they, since 1995 have they adopted this absolutely disastrous housing policy, which has generated record levels of homelessness across the province, huge amounts of housing insecurity right across the province. But in their most recent so-called budget, that phony document they released at the auto plant, and then in the Tory election platform called
The Road Ahead, yeah.
They've said they're going to continue to embrace this notion, even though it's a categorical emphatic failure. You go back to what they promised. They said social housing waiting lists would be cut.
I just read some quotes recently from Brenda Elliott's office through one of her aides, talking about all the money that they have available for municipalities to build shelters and affordable housing units, and all the municipalities have to do is ask them for it.
Yeah, well,
it's unbelievable to me that they could say that, but...
You know, you have to chalk that up to the fact that Brenda Elliott, like a lot of other people, is hoping to get reelected, and the current government is absolutely shameless when it comes to making these kinds of statements. You know, again, you can track back to the days of Al Leach as the first Tory housing minister, and the kinds of statements he was making, which, you know, were absolutely outrageous even then. He said that within 2 years of his government bringing in the policies that they brought in, that there would be 20,000 new affordable rental units in Toronto alone, let alone thousands more across the rest of the province. Well, in fact, 8 years later, there are fewer rental housing units across the whole province than there was in 95 when they were first elected.
I think there's 7,000 units less.
It's not just a question of ideology, and it's not just a question of right-wing property developers versus the left-wing political activists. It's real lives of real people. And to give you one very concrete example, and there's a group in Toronto called the Toronto Disaster Relief Committee that for the last few years has been documenting the number of homeless people that have died on the streets of Toronto. And in May of this year, the Toronto Disaster Relief Committee added the 300th name of homeless people that have died in Toronto. And these are all confirmed names. Incidentally, these are not...
aren't people that are normally like drug addicts or alcoholics. People
there's a whole range. There's babies on the list, women, there's men, there's Aboriginal people, there's new Canadians. Some people died in fires in makeshift shelters where they were living under bridges and that sort of thing.
Unsafe housing.
Other people died from cold injuries in the winter or heat injuries in the summer. How this really impacts on people's lives, on their health, on the ability of children to be able to thrive in school. You know, children simply can't...
Children going all through school, living in a shelter year after year, I've heard.
That's right, and being bounced around from not being properly nourished, so therefore not being able to pay as much attention to their studies. Then you look at the studies like the one done recently by Dr. Stephen Wang, who's an epidemiologist at St. Michael's Hospital in downtown Toronto, and he looked at homeless people and compared the mortality rates among homeless people versus people who were properly housed, and found that homeless people were dying an average of about 8 years younger.
I assume this has been presented to the government time and time again.
It absolutely has, but all you have to do is look at the Road Ahead, their election policy platform. There's not a single, but they do say that they want to bring in new laws to allow the police to be able to scoop homeless people off the streets and force them to go into shelters.
Now, this is the same government that decided to let the mentally ill out of institutions where they were living, saying we want to give them their independence, but these people weren't able to survive on the streets.
The biggest percentage of homeless people are people who are there for financial, for economic reasons, because they got evicted, they couldn't afford their rent. About a third of homeless people, on average, are working people, have jobs.
So now you can be working and still be homeless.
Absolutely. And, you know, you go to places like Brampton, you go to Newmarket and so on. The shelters are full of people who've got jobs, but they can't find a place to live.
Now, are these minimum wage jobs?
Definitely minimum wage jobs. Every year as rents increase, existing housing becomes less and less affordable.
It's just a matter of time then.
Incidentally, homeless shelters in every part of the province are already reporting occupancy rates of 100 to 120%. Now, people may ask, how can you have a place with 120% occupancy rate because 100% is full, right? Well, what 120% means is that they're throwing mats on the floor and they're shoving people on the mats on the floor. And when those get filled up, they're sticking people on the concrete thing between the mats on the floor.
Which explains why some people don't want to even go to a shelter now.
Well, the
we're not even counting those that are still out in the street.
There are a small number of people who are, for various reasons, don't want to go into shelters. Some of the reasons are incredibly smart reasons. Last year, for instance, in Toronto, there was an outbreak of tuberculosis at the largest men's shelter in Toronto, Seton House. There are three confirmed deaths of tuberculosis in the shelter. Now, you know, who in their right mind would want to go into a place like that where you're in a room with 30 to 50 people or more? People are coughing. Who knows what you're picking up in terms of diseases? Some of it also relates back to the issue that you mentioned earlier, which is the mental health issue. And he had been diagnosed with what the psychiatrist called paranoid schizophrenia, which meant that he couldn't stand to be around large groups of people because he'd get it just trigger his delusions. Give him a pass, and they sent him to Seton House. At that time, there were about 700 men that were staying at Seton House every night. That guy didn't even walk through the door of Seton House. He ended up on the streets, and in fact, about 4 or 5 years ago, he froze to death. The response of the authorities was, well, he chose to be out on the streets. He could have come to Seton House. There was a bed for him.
Well, there's that stigma, you know. People on the street choose to be there. People on welfare are bums, and they choose to be there. People that are homeless, they just lack incentive to get a job.
What's interesting about all this now is that the government, the Ontario government, has announced a plan to put $250 million into community mental health programs. All of the people who are familiar with mental health issues are saying you got to put a big chunk of that money into various forms of supportive housing. Now, the government still hasn't announced what it plans to do with that $250 million, and I suspect what they'll do is they'll tease people and say, you know, we'll wait until after the election.
It's not even an honest promise, is it? The Tories have actually added to the homeless problem by the rent controls being changed and the Tenants Act being changed, and middle income people are now finding it difficult to afford their rental unit or even their mortgage, and they're becoming homeless, and I see them turning up in food banks. So it's the middle class working man is now adding to the role, so it's accelerated the situation rather than...
I've issued this challenge for years to see if there was a single landlord who said to a tenant, gosh, I'm sorry, you've now got a 21.6% cut in your welfare check.
Yeah.
That means I'm going to cut your rent by 21.6%.
It's completely ridiculous, isn't it?
Didn't happen. What in fact did happen was that we began to see in ports a 40, 50, 60, 70% increase in the number of evictions that were being processed by the courts. With the changes in the Landlord-Tenant Act in 1998, no longer do landlords have to go to court. They just go to an administrative tribunal, and they can basically get their paperwork rubber-stamped and have somebody out the door really, really quickly. We've heard stories of tenants getting evicted for arrears of as little as $40. Once they're evicted, they've got a vacant unit, and then they can jack the rent up as high as they want. Incidentally, one of the things that the landlords are now... The landlord lobby groups, you know, these same groups that met secretly with the government back in 1995, they're actually beginning to feel the pinch because, you know, we've got this very strange situation in Ontario where we've got a huge affordable housing crisis. And at the same time, the rental vacancy rates in a number of parts of the province have actually increased as well. On the one hand, you have 68,000 households on the social housing waiting list, desperate to find a place to live, and at the same time you've got a rental vacancy rate that increased last year. And so what the landlords are now asking the government to do is to introduce a new subsidy scheme for landlords called a shelter allowance or a shelter subsidy, for the government to put billions of dollars into this huge subsidy scheme. It would be great for them, it would be expensive for taxpayers, wouldn't create any new housing. What we need to do is to go back to the successful programs that did generate good, cost-effective, affordable housing that remains affordable over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. If you had a chance to meet with the Premier, Ernie Eves, at this point face-to-face, what would you want to ask him? What would you want to tell him?
Well, I'd say three very, very simple things to Premier Eves. First of all, that the housing and homelessness disaster in Ontario, which is the worst it's been in any of our lifetimes, is a manufactured crisis. It's one that's been created directly as a result of the policies of his government. The second thing I'd want to say is that as bad as the problem is, and it's enormous, it's a huge problem, hundreds of thousands of households are caught up on the brink of homelessness or actually already homeless, as bad as it is, it actually can be solved relatively easily. The amount of money that's required is about $1 billion a year from the province, which, although it's a lot of money, in one sense, it's not a heck of a lot when you consider that the government, for instance, has offered $13 billion a year in tax cuts, mostly to rich individuals and wealthy corporations. So $1 billion is not that much. So first thing is, there's a huge manufactured crisis. Secondly, the solutions are well within the grasp of the province. We can actually afford them. And the third thing that I would say is that it's only a matter of time, Ernie. It's only a matter of time because the people of this province, the majority of people, every opinion poll shows that people are very upset about the growing housing crisis, growing homelessness, the growing poverty, the social crisis that has been generated by his government. They want action to be taken, and so the government can pretend that the private sector is going to magically wave the problem away or something like that. Well, that's not going to happen. So it's only a matter of time before the people of this province, the electors, the voters, rise up and they say, we've had it, not anymore from you. So, you know, if they want to rescue their political bacon, they have a chance to turn things around. Between you and me, after we left the meeting with Ernie, I would say to you that I don't think there's any chance that this the Conservative government will change their political stripes. I think they're absolutely committed to the policies they've been following for the last 8 years, and I think the only solution is that we've got to get a whole new bunch in that have got a different, more sensible, more compassionate set of policies that that will truly help to build the affordable housing and repair some of the damage that's been done over the last 8 years.
And we hope that they at least listen this time to the people and the voices of people like yourself. We've been talking to Mr. Michael Shapcott. I want to thank you very much for your time, and I want to thank you personally for all the hard work that you do and all the reports that you publish so that people like myself can pass that message along.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay.